This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Of index card distribution. So, Michelle, would you be the czarina of index card distribution? You would be accepting the responsibility to make sure that everyone here gets one of these. Now, you can probably just hand one pack to each section and maybe collect them at the back. Thank you. All right, so now that that is on its way, as you get a card, you, on one side, everybody raise the finger, one, yeah, good. On one side, throughout the session today, you can draw an illustration of something that you hear or see. It could be a caricature of the teacher. It could be a stick figure illustration of an idea. Ideally, it would be related to the content. But I'm not too picky today. And then please await further instructions for the reverse side. We need priorities, things that deserve high and sustained attention. I think we've established that. So on Tuesday, we looked at the priority of promises, the implied commitments that you made when you accepted the position of a teacher. Then we looked at how we keep those promises by demonstrating awareness, demonstrating character, demonstrating competence, and demonstrating humility. Yesterday, we looked at the priority of people and ways of keeping people as priority by making sure that I'm in the classroom for the right reason, that I love people, by running decisions through the "is it good for my students" filter, and by becoming a student of my students, seeking to understand human behavior. I talked about loving to learn, about sharing things from your life, things that are educational or goofy, and the contagiousness of a person who loves to learn. Last evening, we had one of those interesting experiences at home. As I'm told, during the day, there was an episode in the garden. Someone lifted a bean plant, and under the bean plant was a snake, about a 30-inch snake. Now, I've been working, it's mostly ladies at my house, and I've been working to decrease the enmity between ladies and snakes. I've been trying to educate them that snakes are actually our friends and help to control rodent populations. I've had limited success so far. Because apparently, immediately after spotting this snake got into a fight with a hoe and lost. And so I came home and there was a snake carcass on the porch, and they wanted me to examine this. And I noticed a peculiar large lump in the middle of the snake. And I said, aha, I'll bet there's a rodent in there. We ought to cut him open and see. But then I realized that that was messy. I realized I was tired. I realized I needed to get back to work. And I that just did not sound like a good idea to me after all. But my 4-year-old son did not forget. He wanted to dissect the snake. And after a bit, he comes out of the house with a sharp kitchen knife. 4-year-old boys are not supposed to be walking around with sharp kitchen knives. I got the knife away from him. Then we distracted and went and did other things, and he was not forgetting that he wanted to dissect this snake. And so finally, perhaps convicted by what I'd preached yesterday, I finally relented and decided to dissect the snake. So my son and I got the snake. I put its head down over the ledge so it would not come back to life and attack me. I got the knife, and I began slicing its belly open, and I began examining its intestines. Then I made a curious discovery about its intestines. And I quickly, instinctively called the family in to come look at the snake's intestines. Because the snake's intestines were not intestines. This snake was filled with baby snakes. And so, you know, I pulled out a baby snake, you know, about yay long. And then I pulled out another baby snake, and another baby snake, and another baby, and I started lining baby snakes up. You know, and pretty soon there was five, and then there was eight, and then there was a dozen. Then we got to 15. I thought that was a nice number I could remember. And I think I gave up around that point. And then one of the girls took over and began squeezing the innards of the snake to my incision. And they kept getting more snakes. Till it was all said and done, we had about 25 little snakes lined up along this original snake that was only about that big around and this long. It was fascinating. You know, and we're just really fascinated that this girl killed 26 snakes yesterday in my garden. My wife is very grateful. So did I, you know, is that a science lesson? But I don't know. I'm sure your science teacher could probably turn it into one. But I love to learn. And there's this curiosity when we encounter these kinds of things. I love to see the curiosity of children unleashed. One of the great tragedies of our generation is the number of students, particularly at the high school level, who have no sense of curiosity, of loving to learn. They're sometimes referred to as the whatever generation. And it's just beautiful when we can learn to live in a way that counteracts that. Today's priority is the priority of plans. Plans. And the topic of plans, lesson plans, would be an obvious component. There are other areas that should be planned as well, and I really hope to get to them today, but the clock has been so unkind to me this week, I realize I'm not going to get to everywhere I'd like to go. So let's start with the obvious. For today, let's talk about lesson plans. Now, I'm aware that you may hear this in other sessions, but this is a session for newer teachers, and I just want to make sure that no newer teacher leaves this building and launches into their career as a teacher and it has not heard this possibly multiple times, because this is critical, what we do in preparing to teach. So, as we begin to think about plans, step number one is pick a starting point. Pick a starting point. I remember taking my first conventional teaching job. They showed me the classroom. It was big, had a blue floor, had its own little bathrooms, had shelves in the back, had stacks and stacks of books back there. It was nice. And they left me alone. And I wasn't sure what to do in there. Where do I start? What is the first thing I do as a teacher? It really is, at least it was for me, overwhelming. So, as you're sitting in your new classroom, looking at books, looking at the floor, checking out the bathroom, looking out the windows, looking at the desks, what's the first thing you do? Pick a starting point. So my suggestion for picking a starting point is very simple. The first one is pick a subject. Pick a subject. I don't care which one. You may be a subject-specific teacher. You may be teaching all subjects. So pick a subject. Preferably pick a simple one, one that has a textbook. So the first step, pick a subject. You're sitting in your brand new, empty, hollow sounding classroom, no students, it's still summer, pick a subject. Second, identify your curriculum. Is the textbook my curriculum, or does the school provide an additional curriculum? A curriculum is the summary of what my students need to learn in a given subject in a given year in order to stay on course through their elementary and secondary schooling years. Now, in many of our small schools, there is no specialized curriculum. The textbook is your curriculum. And I'm okay with that because it's the reality we face. In many of the larger schools, there will be a personalized, that's not the word I want, a customized curriculum for that school. And that curriculum can bring a lot of advantages to the teachers of that school. And I want to talk about them a little bit because I'm assuming that most of you do not have a customized curriculum in your school. And so I just want to paint a picture. I'm going to kind of digress from my progression here a bit to paint a picture of what a customized curriculum looks like, what the components are, so you just understand a little bit what you don't have and hopefully can make up for that a little bit as you use the textbook as your curriculum. So in a school that has a customized, school-specific curriculum, the school can emphasize particular aspects of each subject that are of particular importance in that school community. So it's a document that says, in third grade math, students will learn. And so a team of teachers, ideally, in that school, sat down and worked through. And they've looked at textbooks, they've looked at best practices, they've pulled from a whole host of places, and they'd say, in our school, what we want students to learn is this in third grade math. And so at the end of developing that with hopefully a number of experienced educators, then they go out and say, now, which textbooks are the best ones to help us fill this need? And so they'll go out and find typically that no textbook perfectly aligns with their curriculum. So they'll pick one that fits the best or covers the most essential pieces. And they'll use that textbook. But in a school that has a customized curriculum, the teacher is responsible for teaching the curriculum, not the textbook. And the textbook is simply a tool to help you along. Again, most of our schools, the textbook is that curriculum. So I'm just comparing and contrasting. As an Anabaptist school, we can develop, if we have a customized curriculum, we can develop a listing of essential beliefs and practices that are really core to our particular community that we want to emphasize through that curriculum, and then implement them in a comprehensive way at strategic grade levels, strategic points. We can reiterate at certain times. In a lot of our schools, there's pieces that we think are important, and one teacher will pick up and develop it, but when that teacher leaves, a lot of times it doesn't get passed on well. But if we have a comprehensive curriculum, hopefully there's a way of passing it on as there's teacher turnover. When we have a customized curriculum, we can, as hopefully a team of experienced teachers, look at how we want Scripture integrated into each particular part of our schooling and then make sure that it gets put there. We may look at our community and say, boy, in our community, we really have a weakness in this particular area. There's some doctrines or there's some practices that are slipping away. And so we're going to make sure that this gets emphasized at these key grades and repeated. And there's a mechanism then for holding that in front of teachers. Maybe a curriculum would, every 4 years during election years, put in a special unit on what it means to be an ambassador for Christ instead of a citizen of this empire. Topics. Sometimes textbooks will cover a particular topic multiple years. So a science text may cover, I'm just randomly picking things, a fifth grade science text may cover weather in fifth grade and in sixth grade in a rather cursory way. They also may cover magnetism in fifth grade and sixth grade in a rather cursory way. And so in a curriculum, it's a formalized way where we sit down and we can talk and say, all right, in fifth grade, the teacher is going to emphasize magnetism, and they're going to dig into it. They're going to build a little motor model, and they're going to really go, but they're going to de-emphasize weather. Even though they're in both textbooks almost evenly, They're just going to learn the vocabulary of weather and dig into magnetism. But then sixth grade, where the book treated them both similarly, next year they're just going to fire up the motor and run it for a little bit, review the vocabulary, but they're going to dive into weather. And so when you have a comprehensive curriculum, you can sometimes work things out that allow you to dig deeper into specific things as we referee between the grades. A customized curriculum is a place to give an overarching objective for a subject. The last school I taught in, we had this fascinating music curriculum that was a potpourri. Is that a nice term? A potpourri of things teachers had selected through the years. You know, so this teacher had decided, well, I think they really should learn about composers. And this one said, I thought they should know music appreciation, different types of music. And this one had said, and it had become this mess. And as we worked on our comprehensive curriculum, we sat down with a team of people and said, what do we care, as conservative Anabaptists, what do we care about that gets conveyed in our music program? Because our music teachers didn't really have a vision for what music could be. And so it was a chance for us to sit down and say, well, there's one thing I know. When a student comes out and graduates from our school, I want them to love to sing. So they're going to do a lot of it here, and they're going to have fun doing it. Now, what are we going to do in each grade to make that happen? They need, and we could go down through, they're going to understand what it means to worship. And you can go down through and define what your objectives are. But until we sat down as a team and really went to write out what are our collective objectives for music at Ephraim Mennonite School, we just had a fairly meaningless kind of wandering in the wilderness in our music curriculum. A customized curriculum is a place to store things like a Bible memory program. This was another mess that we had at our school. We had this teacher taught this Bible curriculum. The next two grades later, they were teaching a different Bible curriculum, and teachers selected which Bible memory passages they wanted students to memorize. And, you know, this teacher picked their five favorite verses, and this one picked theirs, and this one pulled things out of their curriculum. It was a mess. No rhyme or reason. And we sat down as we worked on our Bible memory program in our comprehensive, customized curriculum and said, we're a conservative Anabaptist school. What scriptures do we believe every student coming out of our school should have hidden in their heart? Okay. Well, I think there's some passage we really want them to have. What are some of the problems with our Bible memory program? People complain about it all the time. Parents are frustrated with Bible memory because they have four different children. They're all learning different passages at the same time. How do they get all their children to learn all their different passages? We said, wouldn't it be beautiful if every child in the family was learning the same passages at the same time? We're driving to church on Sunday morning. The whole family can recite Bible memory together. Wouldn't that be wild? And we're like, boy, that's going to be hard. How can we do that with first graders and 12th graders? Well, we worked on that. And over time, we developed a system where we said every student in our school is going to learn the same Bible memory. We may find a way to make it just a little bit easier in first grade, but the reality is we're just going to implement it into every aspect of the lower grades. They're going to really do most of their learning in school. They're really good with rote memory. And so if that grade is learning, they can probably learn almost as much as a lot of the older students who are going to be doing more of it out of school. And so we decide our whole school is going to learn the Sermon on the Mount next year. We're going to divide it up. Every week we're introducing this amount. So that means our old school chapels on Wednesdays, wow, there's always a passage we can recite together. We can always be introducing the new passage then. Whenever we have guest speakers in, we can say, hey, the passage of Scripture the whole school is memorizing right now is this. If you would like to address that, that would be wonderful. And all of a sudden, the whole school had a focus. And we said, you know what? A lot of times you memorize Bible memory, but you forget it after a couple of years. So actually, we're going to have a 6-year plan. So you memorize it in first grade, It comes back around and you memorize the same passage in seventh grade. You memorize it in sixth grade. It comes back around in 12th grade. And so it's this process of having a customized curriculum that forced us to think through some of those things. And then it allowed us to document it and gave us a place where we could hold our teachers accountable. Again, I'm assuming 90% of our schools don't have a document like this. This document is ballooned into a 500-page document at EFRTA. It represents endless hours of work. And many of us schools simply do not have the resources to do that kind of a project. But when you have a resource like that, it gives your school some incredible benefits. When you make a formal customized curriculum, then another typical thing that will be done is at the end of that project, here's the things we want everybody to learn in every grade, then we're going to look for an external standard and say, now, what'd we miss? And there are numerous external standards available that detail what students should learn in every grade. Many states have a state standard. A few years back, there was an attempt by a number of people to create a national standard. Every student in the United States of America should learn this in first grade and this in second grade. Anybody know what that's called? Call it out. Common Core, yes. And that's turned into a nightmare. Because when you try to get 300 million people to think the same way about something, it doesn't work. Especially when you insert politics and political correctness into the process. It's just a nightmare. There are other standards around. And what's ended up is a lot of the states have actually ended up taking Common Core and saying, well, we're going to customize it for our state. But at EFRTA, we went and took the Pennsylvania state standards, lined it up next to ours, and said, you know, boy, there's a number of standards here. We really don't want to have a standard for dance. We'll put that in that standard not met column. But otherwise, we went through and check. And we said, you know, what the secular students are learning, we are learning all the valuable content that they are. Our students are not missing anything. The only thing they're missing is a few things that we said we don't want them learning. And we deliberately marked them. So just so you understand this world, I realize I'm diving in deep right now. I hope I'm not losing you. But just painting a little bit of what's out there before we get back to our progression. The final step here in a curriculum that is customized, then, is typically you're going to hand a teacher a notebook that has their curriculum for their classes at the beginning of the year. And the idea is, now this is what you're responsible to teach. Your textbook's a tool to help you get it done. Here it is. As you complete each thing, you check it off. We're going to check in with you throughout the year. And if you're not staying on pace, we're going to have a talk. Because you're not doing your job. And it's a way of holding a teacher accountable. Whereas in a lot of our schools, teachers sometimes struggle to know whether they're doing their job, much less administration or the board. Now, back from the deep weeds of customized curriculum. Let's say the textbook is your curriculum. Now that you understand a little bit of what's out there, hopefully that will inform how you look at this and say, well, there's some pieces I need to add in besides just using my textbook. How am I going to implement particular Anabaptist beliefs? How am I going to include scripture in my text? Maybe I have a Protestant text in a particular subject. And let's just keep moving on now. So you're in your empty classroom. It's really echoey. No students. I've told you to pick a subject. You've picked one. I've said identify your curriculum. You've picked up a textbook. Great. Let's keep going. Now, your calendar. How long is your school year? A typical state-mandated school year in the state of Pennsylvania is 180 days. 180 days, that's a 36-week school year, 9-week quarters. I'm going to go with that for easy figuring. So, I've picked a subject, identified my curriculum, I'm holding the textbook, I have my calendar. I know how long my year is. So now I pick up my textbook, I turn to the index, and I look for the halfway point in my index. And I draw a line there. That is where I want to be by the end of the second quarter in January. It's pretty simple. This isn't rocket science. There's a lot more complicated ways to explain these kinds of things, but I'm just trying to give you a basic rule of thumb on where to start. So, I found the midpoint. Now, I have the first half of the year in my index. I try to find the midpoint of that. There's 8 units. Okay. After 4 units, I'm drawing another line. This is where I want to be at the end of the first quarter. Okay? So now I have the 4 units I need to cover in 9 weeks, my first quarter. So I have 9 weeks to cover 4 units. That means I need to cover 1 unit every 2 weeks in order to get through this in the appropriate amount of time. And I have a week to spare for tests, quizzes, and the holiday that's thrown in there. Okay, this isn't rocket science, but it's just a basic way of thinking through this process. And then you think about how many class periods you meet. Does this class meet 5 days a week? Okay, over 2 weeks. Okay, I have 10 class. I can break this unit into 10 lessons. Or this unit that I need to cover in the next 2 weeks only meets 3 days a week. That means I have 6 lessons to cover this unit. All of a sudden, I'm feeling a little bit of pressure. I need to keep moving here. Very good. That's what you're supposed to feel. You get a sense of the tempo that you need to use in order to cover your curriculum in a year. And then you want to periodically check back in that index to check your progress against the marks that you've made. It's so easy to get thrown off. A holiday, an unexpected school event, a one-day lesson that stretches into 2. It's normal. Don't be surprised. It's normal. But that's why we need accountability. But without a bird's eye view of my year, it's incredibly easy to get bogged down in your progression. And I'd find myself doing this all the time. I'd dig into something and, wow, this is really interesting. And so I'd start digging a little deeper. I didn't even know this. And I'd just love to share this with my students. And pretty soon, I'm a quarter of the way through that unit 3 weeks into the year. And so, you know, we need to safeguard against that as teachers if we're going to cover the appropriate part of the curriculum. At times, you'll need to make deliberate judgment calls. Sometimes depth is more important than breadth. You may need to skip or speed through a less critical portion. And it's certainly a conversation to have with your principal. What if I don't get through the text, or what if I really do want to skip a particular part? Will my students be left with a gap in their education that's going to come back to bite them next year or the next? Or is it truly okay for me to skip this part? These are the kinds of judgment calls teachers need to make. So let me catch up here. Pick a starting point, pick a subject, identify your curriculum, look at the calendar, and then divide your curriculum. Next is to incorporate the essential elements. Again, I may be repeating some things you've heard elsewhere, but I think they're worth repeating. I may even be contradicting some things you've heard. Please forgive me. There are different ways of looking at these things, but this is the critical part of what we do. This is the daily work of a teacher, managing your curriculum, creating lesson plans. This is what we do. For many of us, after years of practice, standing up and actually delivering the lesson is the fun. That's the gravy. It's the reward that we get for hours of behind-the-scenes lesson planning. This is our work. Some people just revel in that. Wish I did. So I've now identified the unit that needs to be taught in the next 2 weeks. And it's now time for me to begin constructing individual lesson plans. Your lesson plans are one of the most critical elements of your classroom management. There's a fascinating correlation between the quality of my lesson plan and how I execute it and how my students behave. The days that I had a lousy lesson plan and I knew it, guess what my students did? They were awful. It's like, I don't know, something came over them. My lesson plan? Next day, I had a lesson plan that I was good and I knew it. I had something significant to share with my students and I had a good plan for doing it. Fascinating how it changes my students' behavior. With a good lesson plan, students will often forget to misbehave. So, typical lesson plan. Just going to real briefly here, just keep chugging along, running through the elements of a typical lesson plan. This is part of every lesson plan, I hope, but it's a part that students don't see. It's the objective. What do I want to accomplish in a lesson today? I'm going to teach a fourth grade science lesson today. What is it that at the end of this lesson I want my students to know or be able to do? Write it down. It's critical that it's written down. We worked with these things in a number of schools. My successor, I should say, at Ephrata, he actually has become very, he comes from the New York City public school system, and so he is very much a stickler about this. He demands that every teacher in his secondary school, in every class period, walks into their classroom and writes on their board the objective for what their students are going to learn that day. And so as the administrator, he can walk through that school and walk into every classroom in the middle of a lesson, and he sees what the teacher's trying to accomplish. And at the end of the lesson, when the students walk out, he'll say, Joe, so tell me about, can you tell me X? And they go, well, I don't know. He needs to have a conversation with the teacher. Okay, you probably don't have an administrator that's giving you that kind of accountability. But this is our job, to know what we're trying to communicate, not just to stand up there and babble. So, have an objective. Number two, perhaps a hook. A hook is a question, a picture, a riddle, something that pulls the students in. You know, so it's science class. You walk up front and you say, students, what would happen if I mixed this and this? And they're like, I don't know. And you say, it's actually pretty cool. We're going to find out at the end of the lesson. Then go launch into your lesson. You got them. A hook is a simple thing. Sometimes over here with TAP students, they'll spend half an hour trying to figure out a hook. Please don't. If it takes more than 2 minutes, please don't do it. But the idea that you can walk up front and catch their attention, it's a beautiful thing. It's not required, but it's a beautiful thing. And ideally, it leads into the lesson. But it doesn't always even have to do that. One of the great things I just had a lot of fun with my middle school students was to use mind trap questions. I don't know if any of you have seen mind trap before. This is a box with a gazillion questions in it. A lot of the questions are not appropriate for school students. Whoever wrote them seems to have a fascination with bars and murders. But there are probably 150 cards in there that are just awesome for students. And so I go up front, beginning of the day or whenever, beginning of a class, maybe it's the after lunch class where students are sleeping, and I say, all right, guys, get out a piece of paper and a pencil, write down the answer. I have a big bag of candy in my arm, and you get the right answer, you get a piece of candy. All right, listen carefully, folks, no cheating. If you screw a light bulb into a socket by turning the bulb toward the right with your right hand, which way would you turn the socket with your left hand in order to unscrew it while holding the bulb stationary? It's great. Next day. All right, guys. If you were to step into a sealed room filled with 100% methane gas and strike a match, what would happen?
Write it down, folks.
Don't. The next day, I'm going to play with my bag of candy again. Under what conditions would a rope be most likely to break? 20 men of equal strength with 10 pulling on each end? Or 10 of the same men pulling on one end and the other end being fastened to a tree? Or option C, it makes no difference. Just so much fun. Students just love this. Especially if there's a bag of candy involved. you know, and they just pulled in, and, you know, it's just part of this aura, especially at the middle school level, of just being a weird teacher. It's awesome.
A new medical building containing 100 offices had just been completed. Hardy Pyle was hired to paint, great names too, Hardy Pyle, was hired to paint the numbers 1 to 100 on the doors. How many times will Hardy have to paint the number 9? Get on there, 1, 2, 3, when the day after tomorrow is yesterday, today will be as far from Wednesday as today was from Wednesday when the day before yesterday was tomorrow. What is the day after this day?
Yeah, just fun. Love it. Great hooks. Get people going. So you need to have an objective. You need to have a hook. Well, I should say you don't need to have a hook. It's optional, but it's a beautiful add-on. Number three, need an introduction. Please, folks, don't play hide and seek with what you're trying to communicate to students. Some teachers seem to think that it is the glory of the teacher to conceal the matter from their students. You do not get bonus points for hiding from your students what you're trying to teach them. Tell them! All right, folks, today in science, what we want to learn is, say it. And what we're going to do to get there is to do this, this, and this. So hang on for the ride. Let's go. You got an introduction.
Next is the body. This is not a dead body. This is whatever you're doing to actually teach them what you just introduced.
So you're delving into, maybe it is a lecture. Maybe it's a group project. It could be a variety of things. You could be having them do research. There's endless numbers of things that you can do in order to execute the body of the lesson, to convey the material to them. So the body of the lesson is probably taking the longest portion of the class period. Next comes the assessment. Remember that objective? You said, by the end of this class period, I want every student to know or be able to do this. Now, as you're winding the lesson down, your job is to determine, did I accomplish it or not? I need some form of proof that this happened. And that proof can take a million different forms. But as a teacher, if you don't get some proof and you just assume that they learned it, sooner or later you'll probably be getting some unpleasant surprises. And finally, you want a conclusion, a way to wrap it up. It is not good teaching to teach at 95 miles an hour right up until the bell rings and then they walk out of the room. We tend to do it way too much, even me. But it is bad teaching to do that because you get all this information in their short-term memory and then you go, boop, it's like hitting the delete button or all of a sudden there's a power flash and the computer screen goes blank. Yeah, it's not a good way to process it. You want to have some way of concluding that reviews the information, that helps them think about it, that makes them process it, that makes them somehow do something with that information so it has some categories, it has a shelf to rest on in their brain, it has a label so maybe they can retrieve it later. And again, this could take many, many different forms, but a conclusion. And so, in the spirit of conclusions, take out your little 3x5 card that you've been sketching on one side of, and on the other side, I need you to write, let me get this off the screen, there we go, the 6 elements of a lesson plan. You may not leave this room until you hand me that paper with those 6 elements on it. I will plan to be standing by that door, and you do not get lunch until you hand me that paper. This is your ticket out of the room. You're laughing. I'm serious. Write them. 6 things. I need to wrap it up, though, while you write. All right. So the final thing is step 3, and it's very simple. Build plans that are repeatable. I am not the most organized person in the world. I don't even really consider myself to be organized. However, the more experience I've gotten, the more I realize how critical it is to have a system that works. When I did my student teaching at Garden Spot High School in Lancaster County, the department chair, who was my mentor, he said, "The paper tiger will kill you." If you do not learn as a teacher to control papers, they may very well end your life as a teacher. You must learn to subjugate, to bring under control the paper tiger. The importance of organization is doubly critical when it comes to the area of lesson plans. Your ability to organize, edit, retrieve, update your lesson plans, it has a massive impact on your effectiveness as a teacher. It's the difference between whether you're a teacher with 20 years experience or a teacher with 1 year of experience 20 times. It is a big, big deal. You're not going to be a great teacher your first year. You're a first-year teacher, get over it. You won't be a great teacher this year. Isn't that freeing? When I was told that, it was kind of insulting. But then I did realize it was kind of freeing. Okay, got that? First year, you're not going to be a great teacher. If you do really well, you'll be a decent teacher. But what makes a great teacher is a teacher who can build, who the first year gets the basics down, and then that next year they're able to add some extra stories onto that. They're able to add another illustration. They figure out where students' problem points were last year, and they figure out a way around it. And so you're updating your plans, you're adding, you're replacing a crummy field trip with a field trip that actually reinforces something you're trying to teach them. And long about your fifth year, you may be a great teacher, but only if you're organized enough to build year after year after year. I'm out of time. How you store those lesson plans is a big deal. And it's something you need to spend some time thinking about. What is the best way to do that? Teachers need priorities. Priorities of promises. People need to be our priority. But if you're a teacher and you don't have a priority of good plans, you're going to have a tough row. And so, may we all build good plans. Pick a starting point. Incorporate the essential elements and build plans that are repeatable. I'll be waiting by the door for your ticket out of the room. Thank you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.